Counsel. Judge Hawthorne, Judge Berger, and Judge Talbot. My name is Mark Rodefeld, and I'm here to speak today on behalf of Appellants and as well on behalf of the inalienable property rights that came under attack by the lower court's ruling in this matter. By the gracious acknowledgement of this court, my petition pro hoc vice has been recognized. I am a licensed attorney in the states of Illinois, Florida, Texas, and understanding the custom that we're supposed to read a bar number into the case. Texas went along. So for LIFO purposes, it's 240-84701. Your Honors, we appear before you today on appeal of the trial court's dismissal of the appellants and others' causes of action for inverse condemnation on the basis of a 12B1 challenge and a 12B5 challenge. The 12B1 challenge issue related by the trial court dealt with rightness. We believe that particular issue, however, has, through the course of time, become moot, given the fact that during the time period in which briefs were filed in relation to this case, the underlying premise upon which the trial court made a determination that rightness did not exist on the basis that there were special administrative proceedings that were ongoing at that time, and he wanted that to come to fruition before the appellant's claims could go forward. Those have, by everyone's agreement, since resolved. So as to the 12B1 issue, we believe that that is a moot point at this point, and so we don't really need to go into our challenges to rightness beyond what's contained in our particular briefs.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you said it's agreed to, it's stipulated by the parties that the special master's proceedings or special administrative proceedings have all been concluded.
I believe everybody is so stated in their briefs, Your Honor. Yes.
I thought it was a little ambiguous in the briefs. I couldn't really tell. Somebody said, well, it might be.
It's my understanding they are.
Okay.
Thank you. Sure. And with respect to the 12B5 motions.
Excuse me. Before you get to that, Mr. Rodefeld, I have a question that relates to rightness. If all of the claims have been settled, then what is the interest now of the insurance carriers in this case? Because it seems to me the insurers have received at least some money from the state of Colorado and some money from the insurance carriers. So does that mean that the insurers have been received double payments?
No, Your Honor, it does not. With respect to the claims that are brought by the appellants that are before you, their claims have not been compensated by the state of Colorado or for any of the governmental entities in this particular case. It was a very convoluted rubric for purposes of going through the procedures of a special administrator hearing and proceedings, which our clients were precluded from participating in. And so our clients, while they couldn't participate within the special administrator proceedings, they nevertheless had to wait until those were resolved with respect to uninsured claims that were still being brought by perhaps some of their insureds, by people who were not insured, and by people who lost family members in this particular tragic fire. So no, all of the claims were not completely resolved. But all of the claims that were subject to being resolved through that special administrator process have finalized. So I hope that answers your question as to that.
Yes, thank you.
Sure. Now, with regard to the 12B5 motion, we appeal the trial court's error in determining that the public purpose element of an inverse condemnation claim was not sufficiently pled, and further, that the trial court erred in stating that no facts could ever be pled, which would allow for an inverse claim to proceed under the factual rubric of this particular case. In addition, we're asking this court to reverse the district court decision as to each of these two points. We ask that the matter be remanded back to the district court for a full evidentiary hearing after discovery is conducted in the matter, so that the factual underpinnings of these claims could be brought to light in the court. Right now, we're dealing simply with pleadings.
If you were given the opportunity for discovery, what can you give me an idea of what type of information would illuminate the question of whether or not there was a public purpose associated with the, your opponent has called it the second fire. I know you don't like calling it that, but I'll use that term just for the sake of convenience.
I understand your use of the term. There was one fire, and what we would look at for the public purpose element of that particular fire has to do with not the damage that was inflicted or the cost, if you will, of what was inflicted by virtue of the actions that were taken, but for purposes of the public purpose, we would look into issues that would relate to the reasons behind the prescribed burn, the agreements between the two entities that are before the court, the Colorado Forestry Service, as well as the Denver Water Board, to look at those their agreements to see, because part of their arguments are that one of them says, well, we didn't have anything to do with the fire. We just allowed the fire to happen on our land. Those are the kind of things, because the public purpose issue goes to the actual act, the act that took place, not the resulting damage or cost that occurred. And so our investigation, our discovery into the matter would be to more fully develop the balance of the agreements and steps behind the act, which was the intentional setting of a prescribed burn in this public watershed to protect 1.5 million citizens.
But you didn't lose on that issue. I thought the district court assumed, as you pled, that there was a public purpose for the prescribed burn. So, I mean, if the court assumed that in its ruling, why do you need discovery with respect to that determination? You won that issue.
Well, we did for about a paragraph.
Okay.
And then, and then we believe the trial court erred in saying, well, yeah, that was for that fire, but now we have this fire over here, and there was no public purpose for this fire. We have to go on the facts as pled. Facts as pled, one fire that escaped from the standpoint of the prescribed burn escaped at a cost to the few citizens that suffered damage as a result of the fire. So, yes, in fact, the judge properly ruled as to public purpose as to the prescribed burn, but he kind of went off track when he went and said, but now we have two fires. The investigation and part of the discovery would go into how that was one fire. And we pled one fire. We did not plead two fires. Wildfires often get names later on. I've been involved in many a wildfire case. They get names later on. Sometimes they get two or three names as the course of things go and happen. But this fire was initiated on a given date as a prescribed burn. It escaped the boundaries of the prescribed burn area, and it, at the cost of a few citizens, damaged their property for the betterment of others. Because the betterment for others was, in fact, that this particular prescribed burn did what it was intended to do.
I'm sorry. Sure. I don't want to miss the point here. You said it was for the benefit of others. That would have been the public purpose. How did it benefit others that the insured's properties were burned?
Well, clearly, Your Honor, it didn't. That's not the standard of review, and that's not the way we should be looking at the case.
Well, don't we need to understand what the public purpose was?
Yes.
For the taking of the insured's property.
What we have to understand, Your Honor, is, and what we have to deal with, is what was the public purpose behind the act which ultimately led to a taking, but not the, what was the public purpose behind the cost that was associated with it. Our public purpose here was simple. It was to protect the watershed, to protect the water supply for over 1.5 million citizens. The prescribed burn was effective in doing so, as there have been no subsequent fires that have occurred within the watershed as a result of that public purpose. The cost associated with that act is the fact that some people lost their homes. But you don't look at, well, what was the purpose behind the cost? Nobody does that in these cases, as a matter of fact.
Sure, you have to. You have to have a taking, right?
Yes.
For a public purpose. And you're saying that the property of your insurers were taken by the state or a governmental entity.
Yes.
What's the public purpose for that taking? For the taking of the insured property. What's the public purpose?
The public purpose that was involved here was to protect the watershed. That was the public purpose. And the design
for taking the insured property, that was the public purpose, was to protect the watershed?
Your Honor, let me put it in the context of the Scott decision, which is a case that has been cited by both parties mm-hmm. in the case. For a taking to occur, and maybe I'll put it in this context, for a taking to occur, there are two ways that can develop. One, through an intentional act of the government that intends a certain thing to occur. Mm-hmm. Or, as Yogi Berra once said, get a fork in the road, take it. He actually meant what he said in saying that was that there were two ways to actually get to his museum. Both ways were routes that ultimately ended up at the same place. Well, in the takings context, one route is an intentional act that was intended to actually do the harm that was caused, if you will. The Scott case is a perfect example of that. In that case, a road was going to be expanded. Trees were earmarked for purposes of destruction. They intended to cut down these trees. They just so happened to cut down some of Mr. Scott's trees. Mm-hmm. In that particular circumstance, that instance is where we have an intentional act. Now we go in the other route, and we go to a 1962 Colorado Supreme Court case of Farmers Irrigation Company, where there was a hatchery that was developed by the state of Colorado for purposes of creating little fish. And for that purpose, the public purpose there of creating the hatchery was developed through diverting water to the hatchery from others. And in that diversion process, as is set forth in the Trinity case, and Scott also refers to this, there are two ways to do this, either an intentional act, or there are factors which can lead to a understanding that there's a reasonably foreseeable consequential act that can arise by virtue of what you're doing.
But doesn't that go to the taking issue, not the public purpose issue? I understand your argument that under you can have a taking that isn't absolutely intended if it was the foreseeable consequence of something that was intended. But I'm having trouble applying that to the public purpose element.
Well, maybe I'm getting there slowly, but I'm trying to get there. With the Scott decision, I talked about the intentional act relative to taking. But with respect to the farmers' irrigation case, you look at that factual scenario, again, a state Supreme Court decision from 1962, where you have a hatchery and you have a public purpose of creating fish through the hatchery. You divert water to that hatchery. In the process of doing so, you pollute the water. You make water putrid so that people downstream can no longer, and that putrid water escapes from the hatchery and then infiltrates into the water supply of other people. It wasn't the intention of the state of Colorado to create putrid water for other people. The public purpose there was to create a hatchery. They didn't intend, by virtue of creating that hatchery, to pollute the water supply for those other people downstream. Just as here, there was no intention in setting a prescribed berm for it to ultimately escape, as the putrid water escaped in farmers, and go to an other's property and damage it. But it occurred, and that was the cost. That was the cost that was inflicted by virtue of the public purpose that was taken. So in that particular instance, you see an illustrative example of how public purpose can apply to circumstances where there isn't really consideration given to the ultimate net damage that occurs to limited view.
Well, let me ask you this, then. Can you have an unintentional taking which does not have a public purpose?
Can you have an unintentional taking that does not have a public purpose? Certainly. And I think there was a case involved, a case I think both sides cases cited, where it was a California decision where a burn was occurred by the side of the city hall, and the public purpose there was to keep fire from spreading from that little area over to where a couple of houses were involved. Well, in that particular case, I'm trying to remember the name of it, started with a W. Sorry, I can't remember it right now. But in that particular instance, the court held there was no public purpose because that was really just to handle a couple of few, protect a couple of few homes and not the entirety of the village and the town itself. So yes, they didn't intend to burn the house down, obviously, that was next door. They actually intended to protect it from being burned down.
Isn't that the case here? They didn't intend to burn the insured's properties. They intended to protect this, what was it called, 4A?
True.
4A.
The only difference being, in that particular case, there was no public purpose to simply protect for a couple of homes over here from being burned, because there the court found, based upon the facts in that case, which all these cases are very fact specific, but based upon the facts of that particular case, there was no public purpose in doing that act to protect the town in the entirety. Much different here. We have a public purpose to protect the watershed for 1.5 million people, and that public purpose was advanced. It was successful, but it came at a cost. And that particular cost is what we are here in pleading for the inverse claims that have been brought.
Let me ask you a question. I know that your time is getting short, but I want to ask
this. I did want to reserve a couple of minutes, but that's fine.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You mentioned before that we're talking about pleadings. We're looking at the sufficiency of the pleadings. And so I want to ask if any of the insurance carriers in the what I would call the operative pleadings pled at any time a public purpose for the taking of their insured's property?
Not in those words, Your Honor. No, not in those words. And by the way, the pleadings that were at issue here were not just pleadings by the insurers, they were individuals too.
So we have, you may confirm this for me because it's not clear from the briefs. I have that the operative pleadings are the third amended complaint, the amended response and interpleader, and then we have some other pleadings from Progressive Preferred Insurance, American National Property, and Respondent Colorado Farm Bureau. Is that your understanding of what the operative pleadings are?
For purposes of the appellants, yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes, Your Honor. Again, the public purpose that was set forth in the pleading was what I have expressed to you here right now.
So there's been no other pled public purpose than what you've expressed right now?
Generally, not in my precise words, because different people crafted the different complaints, but generally speaking, it's that.
Great.
I did want to reserve a couple of minutes. I'm down to 1.5, so I think I'm going to reserve my time here.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Tom Rice, registration number 9923. Today I represent the Denver Water Board. Also looking at the council table is Will Allen from the Attorney General's office. I will yield some time to him to speak on behalf of the state once I have concluded my remarks. It is important to understand that in this case, the plaintiffs are asking this court to create new law that we believe is at odds with prior pronouncements from both this court and the Colorado Supreme Court. It's also, I believe, very important to observe that although this case has now been fully briefed twice by the insurers, they haven't cited a single case, not one, from any jurisdiction where a controlled burn's been found to constitute an act of inverse condemnation. And there's good reason for that, because as the court's discussion here this morning, I think, points out, there's one element that's clearly missing, and a second element that we believe is also missing. Let me speak first to the public purpose or benefit issue. As Judge Hoffman has observed, and I agree with Your Honor, that those are the operative pleadings in terms of what claims are before the court here today.
Thank you. And let me interrupt you just a minute. Do you also agree that all claims that were subject to the special administrative process have been handled and resolved?
You know, I really can't speak to that because we have not had any involvement in it whatsoever, because that was a state procedure, and there may be some loose ends that exist in those things, but we are not raising rightness with respect to the insurer's claims.
Okay.
So that's not an issue that we are asking this court to take account of here.
Thank you.
These plaintiffs do not and cannot allege that the government obtained a benefit from the unintended burning of the insured properties. Instead, they rely on what the trial court referred to as this imputed public purpose theory. The idea being that if the original action undertaken by the state or Denver Water had some public purpose to it, that then somehow everything that happens after that is imputed to that and becomes a part of that public purpose. The problem with that theory is it enjoys absolutely no support in the law. Again, although they argue this and urge the court to decide that way, they haven't cited a single case which so holds. Also, I would argue that if we accept that as the doctrine, namely that if the original act of the government had a public purpose to it, anything that happens after that has that imputed to it, then I would suggest that anything that the state does, anything that my client does, anything that any public entity does that has unintended consequences that befall that come out of it, then it all becomes an inverse condemnation. And quite clearly in this state, our courts have drawn a distinction between inverse condemnation and tort.
Do you agree with, I'm sorry, is Mr. Rodefeld, thank you. With Mr. Rodefeld, that there can be a taking without a public purpose?
No. A public purpose is essential. It's a sine qua non, as it were, of a taking, of an inverse condemnation or an imminent domain proceeding. You have to have a public purpose. And that public purpose has to translate into a benefit. They haven't alleged any benefit, nor could they. In fact, this fire worked cross purposes with the very public purpose that the government entities had in lighting this fire. The reason that they lit this fire was to control fires. And the fact that what came out of it was a wildfire that very unfortunately destroyed a great deal of property and indeed cost some lives. That speaks to the fact that this was against their purposes. So to say that this served the public's purpose is wrong. This was absolutely the opposite. It caused the public purpose to not be served.
Well, let me ask you, I'm going to go back to the taking without a public purpose. And I know that you disagree with the trial court that there was a taking here.
Yes.
But if we assume there was a taking, let's assume the trial court was right, that the insurance properties were burned because of the natural, direct, probable consequence of the department's actions. If that's the case, would that constitute, you're saying that wouldn't constitute a taking?
Well, it would meet the taking element requirement.
Yes.
But it wouldn't be a taking in the sense that it's an inverse condemnation.
So we could have a taking without a public purpose.
Absolutely. If this court were to find that there were sufficient facts pled to meet the taking requirement, but also find that there were not sufficient facts pled to meet the public purpose requirement, then there would be no inverse condemnation, just the same. And in fact, that's the way the trial court found it.
Is the question of whether or not there's a public purpose, is that a factual issue or is that a legal issue?
Well, there has to be some pleading we're at the Rule 12 stage, of course, and so all the well-pled facts have to be taken as true. But well-pled facts mean facts, not conclusions. And so to simply state in some ritualistic form that there was some public purpose is insufficient. They have to state something which on this court's review, de novo, you can find that there actually was a public purpose to translate it into a benefit for the public entities. One of the principal distinctions between a tort and eminent domain and inverse condemnation is that the government has a benefit conferred upon it for the public's benefit that it doesn't pay for. That is the whole concept of inverse condemnation. And so the private property owner has a benefit taken from him, and then he is not compensated for by the government. That's the very definition of inverse condemnation. But if we take away that benefit, now we're talking about tort. We're no longer talking about inverse condemnation, constitutional claim. So they have to plead, Judge Berger, sufficient facts that you can find that there was a public purpose there. And I repeat, other than some ritualistic, conclusory type allegation, there is nothing in any of these operative pleadings that identifies any benefit to the public entities from having burned these adjoining lands. None whatsoever. Mr. Grotefeld, in his argument, and indeed in the briefing, makes reference to this foreseeability issue. And unfortunately, what occurs here is they're conflating the discussion of taking and trying to graft it onto the discussion of the public purpose. They're unrelated. They're separate. Both have to be met. And foreseeability hasn't got anything to do whatsoever with the issue of whether or not there's a public purpose or benefit from the government authorized action that occurred. In fact, it's at odds with the whole concept of a taking, in that the government, as I've said, has to realize a benefit from it. Now, let me, if I could, address the taking issue. I urge the court that this doesn't even have to be addressed unless, if there's a finding that there's no public purpose or benefit. But that having been said, whether or not something to taking is a question of law for the court, okay? And again, the same standard when we talk about Rule 12 applies. We have to look at all the well-pled facts, those that are not conclusory, and say, do they state something here which meets the definition of a taking within the meaning of Colorado law? Colorado law, as most clearly expressed in the Trinity Broadcasting case, basically says there's two ways you can get to taking. One is the government actually intended to take the subject property. And the second is this idea that the government undertakes an authorized act and that the probable and natural consequence of that authorized act is to result in the loss of property that's in question here.
Why isn't that the case here? The government undertook an authorized act.
They did indeed, but we have to look at what the authorized acts are, okay? And so if we look at the operative pleadings, there are basically three intentional acts that the plaintiffs allege. The first is that they ignited the controlled burn. The second is that there was a patrol scheduled for March 25th that was canceled and then was set to resume on March 26th. And then the third thing they allege is that fire protection equipment was broken down and prepared to be loaded out for transport on March 26th. Those are the three intentional acts that they claim in this case. And we'll assume for the sake of argument that those were all authorized acts. The problem with that is there's nothing inherent, there's nothing in the character of any of those acts that leads to the conclusion that it's probable that they're going to result in burning neighboring property. In fact, the idea of a controlled burn is that it will be contained, that it won't go to neighboring property. And in fact, the vast majority of controlled burns that occur never get to that point.
But isn't that a factual issue that can't be determined at this stage of the litigation?
I believe not, because what we have to do within Trinity Broadcasting is look at the character of the act and say, does that act in and of itself lead to the conclusion that it's probable, not foreseeable in the sense of negligence? That's the language, what I call, in other words, explanation part of Trinity Broadcasting. It has to be natural and probable. And so we have to look at the character of those actions and say, is it natural and probable that that action is going to result in burning neighboring property? Let me contrast something different, and that is a case where the government decides to build a dam. They're going to dam up a stream. And so they say, we're going to take that dam, we're going to raise the water level on this, this stream 45 feet. It is inescapable, it is probable, it is the natural consequence of that, that any land that's under that 45-foot mark is going to be underwater and taken. There's no way around it. You cannot do the dam and not take those properties. On the other hand, the things we're talking about here, ignited controlled burn, can and almost always are undertaken without that occurring. And that's the difference. And that's something that we have to look at, we believe, as a matter of law. In fact, the cases, all the cases that look at this issue in the context of fires in forested areas have reached that conclusion. The most predominant being Cary and Thune, both those being federal cases, but still construing the Fifth Amendment, which is analogous to our constitutional provision here. And they found in those cases that as a matter of law, on a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, that what was alleged was insufficient. And in so saying, they said, look, we can't look at these intervening things like wind. And Thune even goes so far as to say, even if wind is foreseeable, you can't add that to the calculus to say whether or not within the meaning of natural consequence that this fire is a natural consequence of the act chosen. So the answer to your question, Judge Berger, we do believe it is a question of law based upon the allegations that are made and not a factually intensive question whatsoever.
And how would you phrase the test that we should apply?
The test that you should apply is whether or not the character of the act alleged is such that it is the natural, probable, and likely result that the alleged taking is going to occur. Not considering externalities, not considering implementation errors and negligence. The Authorized Act is what we have to look at. And the Authorized Act here is setting the control. I might add that it's really instructive to the question that you've asked, Judge Berger, is that the plaintiffs, despite the fact that they briefed this case for many, many pages, have yet to tell us what their rule is. They want to say that every case has to be cited on its own, but they don't ever urge any rule upon this court of how we decide which cases are takings and which ones are not. And that's, I believe, a real weakness in their approach. We have to look back to the case law that we have, which is Trinity Broadcasting. Scott uses the verbiage unavoidable. There's a Texas case, City of Austin, that I believe uses the phraseology substantially certain. To me, they're all synonymous with each other. What we're saying is that it's not just Paul's graph negligence kind of foreseeability. It's a different kind of foreseeability that gets to probabilities and likelihood.
Well, it seems like what the carriers, to me, it seems like what the carriers are saying is that when we're talking about the direct natural and probable consequences of an act, that if the burn in the second fire or in the burning of the insured's properties, if that was the natural, probable, and natural, direct, and probable consequences of the intended act, the intended purpose for the intended act somehow transmuted to that the other properties.
I think that's what they're saying.
And what's your response to that?
That there's no law that supports that. There's separate requirements, and you can't take one and put the other on it. The concept of an inverse condemnation is that the government got a benefit that it didn't pay for. That is the whole idea of inverse condemnation. And here, the government's enjoyed no benefit whatsoever as a result of having had these properties burned.
Are you saying that this just doesn't fall in an inverse condemnation?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Cause of action?
Yes,
that they might have a tort claim?
This is a tort. This is a tort. And you know, that's an important issue here, because the only reason we're before this court is because the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act exists. And if the Immunity Act didn't bar these claims, we wouldn't be talking about inverse condemnation. Yet the Governmental Immunity Act carries with it very, very important public policies in this state, and that is that we're going to find a limited set of circumstances in which we're going to waive immunity for the state and its subdivisions to protect them against runaway liabilities. And the state has decided through the Governmental Immunity Act that this sort of action is not one for which tort will be waived. And to now change that to this creative theory of trying to turn it into an inverse condemnation will put liabilities on my client, the state, and others that were never planned for and certainly not anticipated in light of the tort immunity that those agencies enjoy.
Let me switch directions just a little bit here. Are you still maintaining that there was not an adequate allegation of standing here or based upon subrogation rights that the insurance carriers
have? You know, Judge Hawthorne, I think that's a really good segue because I was noticing that I need to save some time for the state. My client did not raise the issue that you were questioning here. That was raised by the state, so I think that probably the best thing for me to do there is to yield the rest of the time to the Attorney General and let him answer that and any other questions you have.
Mr. Rice, before you do yield your time to the Attorney General, I just want to come back and ask you a question about rightness, which you mentioned at the beginning. As you know, the trial court judge said that the case wasn't right, as well as deciding on the issue of inverse condemnation. And he phrased the ruling about rightness in terms of the jurisdiction of the court. You said you weren't pursuing rightness this morning on appeal, but don't you have to do more than that and concede that the case is now ripe for adjudication?
And I don't believe that my client raised rightness as an issue, but I do concede that it's ripe for adjudication as to these plaintiffs for certain, because I don't believe the rightness issue ever applied to them anyway. But only the rightness issue applied to the homeowners who also had inverse condemnation claims then pending and were addressed by the same order that brings us here today, Judge Thomas.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks to the court very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Judge Hawthorne, Judge Berger, and Judge Sullivan. My name is Will Allen, and I represent the state of Colorado, and more specifically, the Department of Public Safety in this matter. I have obviously been listening to what's been going on. Judge Sullivan, to address your question about rightness, there were two processes that went on in this case that involved compensation to the insurers. One was the special master process where evidentiary hearings were held. The special masters came up with figures for money that they would award to the insurers. And the second was a legislative process under 2410.114.5b where insurers could apply. It was essentially a change in the law where insurers could apply to the legislature to be paid for their losses arising from the Laramie Airport fire, the retroactive waiving of immunity. Both of those processes have completed at this time. The special master process was going on at the time the district court dismissed the carrier's claims. As to the carriers in particular, we would agree that rightness is no longer an issue of subject matter jurisdiction that this court needs to consider. We also believe that the homeowners have been fully compensated at this point. In terms of subject matter jurisdiction and the carrier standing to maintain this claim, as we brief, we would submit to the court that there is no case law in Colorado which the claims fail because there's no case law in Colorado which provides the carriers a legally protected interest in their insurer's personal constitutional claims. In other words, to bring an inverse condemnation claim on behalf of their insurers. In fact, an inverse condemnation claim is more than likely specifically excluded from the policy. In other words, if those insurers went to their carriers and said, the government's condemning my property, they're not giving me enough, you need to pay me for the remainder, they would tell their insurers that they have no intention of covering those losses.
But we don't know that, do we?
We don't know that, Your Honor. It doesn't actually make any difference whether the essentially what the carriers are arguing is that regardless of whether they are subrogated to their insured's interest through equitable subrogation or through conventional or contractual subrogation, that they can bring any claim that they would like against the state of Colorado, even a claim for which they don't insure. That, there is no case law in Colorado that holds that they can do that. In the sense of equitable subrogation.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a Supreme Court case, DeWitt, that says regardless of how the subrogation right arises, a subrogated insurer stands in its insured shoes, quote, for all legal purposes, and may pursue any rights held by the insured subrogor?
American Family Insurance, which is one of the claimants in this case, versus DeWitt, it indeed talks about subrogation. They do stand in their insured shoes for their legal rights. However, the case goes on to discuss the difference between equitable. I have.
Just finish your sentence. So I go ahead and finish
my
sentence.
When it starts to count up, I start to get nervous. It does go on to explain the difference between equitable subrogation and conventional subrogation. Under equitable subrogation, the carriers would, if there's not a contract right to subrogate, the carriers would limit equitable remedies. I don't believe that there's an equitable remedy for the enforcement of a personal constitutional right in the sense of a taking.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your very interesting arguments. The cases. I'm sorry, you have rebuttal.
I have a lot.
You have 1 minute. You have 1 minute and 24 seconds
to say about 10 minutes of things.
Connors, just briefly, I want to just address a couple of the points that were discussed with my learned opponents. One counsel said that there's no benefit derived to government. There's no benefit derived to government. There cannot be a public purpose. I urge this court to look at the U.S. Supreme Court decision that we have cited, Arkansas Game and Fish. There, trees died in flooding. There was no public purpose in killing those trees. I urge this court to look at Farmers Irrigation again. Water was polluted. There was no public purpose in polluting the water. To say that no law supports taking goes contra to the findings in Farmers Irrigation by the Supreme Court of the state of Colorado and the United States Supreme Court in Arkansas Game and Fish. The pled facts issue, contrary to the government's arguments that they made, we pled many other controlled burns had escaped in the time period when this controlled burn was in the process of being lit. We have pled facts. Our clients deserve the opportunity to argue those facts and be able to present their claims under a takings case. My time is up. Thank you, Justices, for your time today.
Thank you very much for your interesting arguments. The case is submitted, and we will issue a written opinion.